You are listening to rudolfsteineraudio.com. This is a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled From Jesus to Christ. This is Lecture 9. The lectures given so far have led chiefly to two questions. One relates to the objective event connected with the name of Christ Jesus, to the nature of that impulse which, as the Christ impulse, entered into human evolution. The other question is, how can an individual establish his connection with the Christ impulse? Or in other words, how can the Christ impulse become effective for the individual? The answers to these two questions are, of course, connected. For we have seen that the Christ event is an objective fact of human earth evolution, and that something real, something actual, comes forth to meet us in the resurrection. With Christ there arose out of the grave a kind of germ for the reconstruction of our human phantom. That which rose with Christ out of the grave as germ is able to incorporate itself in those individuals who find a connection with the Christ impulse. That is the objective side of the relationship of the individual man to the Christ impulse. Today we wish to add to the considerations of the last few days the subjective side. We will try to find an answer to the question, how does the individual now find it possible, gradually, to take into himself that which comes forth through the resurrection of Christ? To answer this question, we must first differentiate two things. When Christianity entered into the world as a religion, it was not merely a religion for men of occult striving, that is, for those who wished to approach Christ by one or other of the spiritual paths. Christianity was to be a religion which all men could make their own, one which could be accepted by all. To find the way to Christ, especially occult or esoteric development was not necessary. We must therefore, first of all, fix our attention upon that path to Christ, the exoteric path, which every soul, every heart, can find in the course of time. We must distinguish this exoteric path from the other, from the esoteric path, which up till now, up to our own time, has revealed itself to the soul which desired to take it, to the soul which did not merely wish to seek the Christ by the external path, but which desired to seek him by gaining access to occult forces. We must distinguish between the path of the physical plane and the path of the supersensible worlds. In hardly any other century has there been such obscurity concerning the outward, exoteric way to Christ as in the 19th. And again, the course of the 19th century was such that the first half was freer from obscurity than the second. More and more men have lost the knowledge of the way to Christ. Those who share the thought of today no longer form for themselves the right ideas. For example, ideas such as souls, even in the 18th century, formed on their way to the Christ impulse. Even the first half of the 19th century was illumined by a certain possibility of finding the Christ impulse as something real. But for the most part, in the 19th century, this path to Christ was lost to men. And we can understand it when we consider that we are standing at the beginning of a new path to Christ. We have often spoken of the new way which opens itself to souls, that is to say, of a renewal of the Christ event. It is always so in human evolution that a kind of lowest point must be reached in a movement before a new light comes again. The turning away from the spiritual worlds, which has taken place in the 19th century, is only natural in face of the fact that in the 20th century, a quite new epoch for the spiritual life of men must begin in the special manner which we have often mentioned. It frequently appears to those who have interested themselves in theosophy, as if the theosophical movement as we have it was altogether something new. If we look away from the enrichment which theosophical endeavor in the West has latterly experienced through the inflowing of ideas of reincarnation and karma, if we look away from this inflowing of the teaching of repeated earth lives and its significance for the whole of human evolution, we must say that in other respects the ways into the spiritual world, which are very similar to our theosophical ones, are not in the least something new for Western human evolution. He, however, who tries to rise into the spiritual world along the present path of theosophy, finds himself somewhat estranged from the way in which theosophy was cultivated in the 18th century. At that time, in this neighborhood, Baden, and especially in Württemberg, much theosophy was studied. But everywhere, a lucid view of the teaching of repeated earth lives was lacking, and thereby a shadow was cast over the whole field of theosophical work. For those who could look deeply into occult connections, and especially into the connection of the world with the Christ impulse, what they saw was overshadowed for this reason. But within the whole horizon of Christian philosophy and Christian life, something like theosophical effort arose continually. This striving toward theosophy was active everywhere, even in the outward exoteric paths of men who could not go further than to share externally in the life of some congregation, Christian or otherwise. How theosophic effort penetrated Christian effort is shown by the mention of such names as Bengel and Ettinger, who worked in Württemberg, men who in their whole way of thinking, when we take into account that to them the idea of reincarnation was lacking, reached absolutely all that man can reach of higher views concerning evolution, inasmuch as they had made the Christ impulse their own. The fundamental principle of theosophic life has always existed. Consequently, there is much that is correct in a treatise upon theosophical subjects written by Ettinger in the 18th century. In the preface to a book on Ettinger's work, published in 1847, Rotha, who taught in the Heidelberg University, has written the following, quote, "What theosophy really wants is often difficult to recognize in the case of the older theosophists, but it is nonetheless clear that theosophy, as far as it has reached today, can claim no scientific existence, and its effect cannot spread more widely. It would be very hasty if one were to draw the conclusion that theosophy is only an ephemeral phenomenon, and entirely unjustifiable from a scientific standpoint. History already testifies loudly enough to the contrary. It tells us how this enigmatic phenomenon has never been able to accomplish anything, and yet, unnoticed, it is continually breaking through afresh, held together in its most varied forms by the chain of a never-dying tradition." Close quote. Now we must remember that he who wrote this only learned about theosophy in the 40s of the 19th century, as it had passed over from many theosophists of the 18th. What came over was certainly not clothed in the forms of our scientific thought. It was therefore difficult to believe that the theosophy of that time could affect wider circles. Apart from this, such a voice coming to us out of the 40s of the 19th century must appear significant when it says, quote, "And the chief thing is that when theosophy has once become a real science, and has thus clearly yielded definite results, these will gradually pass into matters of general conviction, will become popular, and take their place among the commonly accepted truths which could not be reached by the paths upon which they were discovered, and could only be discovered." Close quote. Certainly, there follows a paragraph of a pessimistic tendency with which, in regard to theosophy, we of today can no longer agree. For he who is familiar with the present form of theosophic effort is convinced that this theosophy, in the way in which it desires to work, can become popular in widest circles. Consequently, even such a paragraph may inspire us with courage when we read further, quote, "Still this rests in the lap of the future, and there we will not encroach. For the present, we will gratefully rejoice in what our valued Ettinger has so beautifully set forth, and which may certainly count upon a sympathetic reception in a wide circle." Close quote. Thus we see that theosophy is a pious hope of those who from the 18th century knew something of the old theosophy. After that time, the stream of theosophic life was buried under the avalanche of materialism of the 19th century. Only through that which we may now accept as the dawn of a new age do we approach again the true spiritual life, and now in a form which can be so scientific that every heart and every soul can really understand it. In the 19th century, the understanding was entirely lost for something that the theosophists of the 18th century still fully possessed, and which they then called in German Zentralsinn, English inner light. Ettinger, who worked in Murrhardt, near Karlsruhe, was for a time the pupil of a quite simple man in Thuringia called Fulker, whose pupils knew that he possessed what was called inner light. What at that particular time was this inner light? It was none other than that which now arises in every man when earnestly and with iron energy he follows that which is to be found in my book, titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds and Its Attainment. It was really nothing else than this simple man in Thuringia possessed. Read that again. It was really nothing else which this simple man in Thuringia possessed. That which he brought into existence, for his time a very interesting theosophy, was the teaching which worked upon Ettinger. It is difficult for the man of the present day to reconcile himself to the knowledge that such a deep theosophical study existed so recently, and that such a study possesses a rich literature, buried though it is in libraries and among antiquarians. Something else is also difficult for the man of today, vis-à-vis to accept the Christ event first of all as an objective fact. How much discussion on this matter has there not been in the 19th century? It is quite impossible in a short course such as this to indicate, even in outline, how many and divers are the views of the 19th century concerning Christ Jesus. And if anyone takes the trouble to inquire further into opinions concerning Christ Jesus, be they the views of theologians or of laymen, he meets with really definite difficulties, if the views of the 19th century on this question are considered in relation to the times in which better traditions still prevailed. In the 19th century, it has even become possible for persons to be regarded as great theologians who are far removed from any acceptance of an objective Christ who entered into and worked in the history of the world. And here we come to the question, what relationship to the Christ can that individual find who takes no esoteric path, but remains entirely in the field of the exoteric? As long as we stand on the ground on which theologians of the 19th century actually stood, that human evolution is something which can take its course purely in the inner being of man, something which has, so to speak, nothing to do with the external world of the macrocosm, we cannot reach an objective appreciation of Christ Jesus at all. We come to all kinds of grotesque ideas, but never to a relationship with the Christ event. To him who believes that he can reach the highest human ideal conformable to earth evolution merely by an inner soul path, through a kind of self-redemption, to him a relationship with the objective Christ is impossible. We may also say that wherever the thought of redemption is for man, something that permits of being answered by means of psychology, there is no relationship to the Christ. He who penetrates further into cosmic mysteries soon finds that when a man believes that he can attain his highest ideal of earth existence solely through himself, only through his own inner development, he cuts off altogether his connection with the macrocosm. Such an one believes that he has the macrocosm before him as a kind of nature, and that his inner soul development, side by side with the macrocosm, is something running parallel with it. But a connection between the two he cannot find. This is exactly what is so frightfully grotesque in the evolution of the 19th century. That which needs a connection, microcosm and macrocosm, splits in two, has been torn asunder. If this had not happened, all those misunderstandings could not have arisen which are attached to the term, quote, theoretical or abstract materialism, close quote. Reflect that the sundering of microcosm and macrocosm has led men who pay but little attention to the inner soul life, so far that they assigned the inner soul life as well as the outer corporeality to the macrocosm, thus making everything subject to material processes. I'm going to read that sentence again. Reflect that the sundering of microcosm and macrocosm has led men who pay but little attention to the inner soul life so far that they assigned the inner soul life as well as the outer corporeality to the macrocosm, thus making everything subject to material processes. Others, aware that there is nevertheless an inner life, have fallen gradually into abstractions concerning everything of significance to the human soul. To be clear regarding this difficult matter, let us recall something very significant that was learned in the mysteries. How many people today believe in their innermost consciousness? Quote, if I think something, for instance, if I entertain a bad thought about my neighbor, that has really no significance for the outer world. The thought is only in myself. It has quite a different significance if I give him a box on the ear. That is something that happens on the physical plane. The other is a mere feeling, or a mere thought. Close quote. Or, how many people are there who when they fall into a sin or a lie or an error, say, quote, that takes place in the human soul, close quote. And in contrast with this, when, say, a stone falls from the roof, quote, that is something that takes place externally, close quote. And they explain lightheartedly, by means of crude sense concepts, that when a stone falls, perhaps accidentally, into water, ripples are formed in the water, which play still further, that everything produces effects which continue unseen. But that which takes place in the soul of a human being is shut away from all else. Consequently, people could come to the belief that to sin, to err, and then to make it good again, is entirely an affair of the individual soul. On such a consciousness as this, something which a large number of us have met with in the last 2 years must work grotesquely. Let me recall to you the scene in the Rosicrucian drama titled The Portal of Initiation, where Capasius and Strader enter the astral world, and where it is shown that that which they think, speak, and feel is not without significance for the objective worlds, for the macrocosm, but actually releases storms in the elements. For the modern man, it is really absurd to think that destructive forces can affect the macrocosm through somebody's having had wrong thoughts. In the mysteries, it was made very clear indeed to the pupil that when, for example, anyone tells a lie or falls into error, it is a real process which has not merely to do with himself. The Germans say, quote, thoughts are duty-free, close quote, because they do not see the customs barrier when the thoughts loom up. Thoughts belong to the objective world. They are not merely experiences of the soul. The pupil of the mystery saw, quote, "When thou tellest a lie, it signifies in the supersensible world a darkening of a certain light. And when thou dost perpetrate a loveless action, something in the spiritual world is in consequence burned up in the fire of lovelessness. With errors, thou dost extinguish light in the macrocosm." Close quote. The effect was shown to the pupil through objective experience. How, through an error, something is extinguished on the astral plane, and darkness follows. Or, how through a loveless action, something works like a burning and destroying fire. In exoteric life, man does not know what is going on around him. He is really like an ostrich with his head in the sand. He does not see effects which nevertheless are there. The effects of feeling are there, and they would be visible for the eyes of sense if the man were taken into the mysteries. It was not until the 19th century that anyone could say, quote, "Everything in which a man has sinned, everything in which he is weak, is his personal affair only. Redemption must come about through an experience in the soul, and consequently, Christ can also be only an experience in the soul." Close quote. Not only that man may find his way to Christ, but that he may not sunder in any way his connection with the macrocosm, the knowledge is necessary. Quote, "If thou dost incur error and sin, these are objective, not subjective experiences. Something happens outside in the cosmos." Close quote. And in the moment in which a man becomes conscious that with his sin, with his error, something objective happens, in the moment when he knows that what he has done and what he has given out from himself is not merely connected with himself, but with the whole objective course of cosmic development, then this man, if he now surveys the whole course of cosmic evolution, will no longer be able to say to himself that compensation for what he has brought about is only an inner concern of the soul. There is indeed a possibility, and it has a good significance, vis-à-vis that the man who sees that thoughts and feelings are objective may also see that that which has brought and brings people into mistakes and frailties comes through successive earth lives. Consequently, he may look upon these thoughts and feelings not as an inner matter of the single life, but as a matter of karma. But an event which is not historical and does not belong to humanity, as is the case with the Luciferic influence in the old Lemurian period, could not possibly be removed again from the world by a human event. There is no possibility of that. Through the Luciferic event, the great benefit came about for man, on the one side, that he became a free being. But on the other, he had to take into the bargain that he might err from the path of the good and the right, from the path of the true. What has happened in the course of incarnations is a matter of karma. But all that has crept in, down out of the macrocosm, into the microcosm, all that the Luciferic forces have given to man, is something that man cannot deal with himself alone. To compensate for this, that is, for the objective Luciferic event, another objective act is needed. In short, man must feel that what he incurs as error and sin is not merely subjective. An experience in the soul which is merely subjective is not sufficient to bring about redemption. Thus he who is convinced of the objectivity of error will also directly understand the objectivity of the act of redemption. One cannot in the least treat the Luciferic influence as an objective act, without treating in the same manner the compensating act, the event of Golgotha. For a theosophist, there is really only the choice between two things. Everything may be set on the foundation of karma. Of course, that is absolutely right as regards everything that man himself has brought about. But then we come to the necessity of lengthening out at will the repeated lives forward and backward. There is no end, forward or backward. It always goes round and round like a wheel. The other thing is that concrete idea of evolution which we must hold, vis-à-vis that there was a Saturn, Sun, and Moon existence, which are quite different from the Earth existence, that it was in the Earth existence that that kind of repeated Earth life, as we know it, first took place, that the Luciferic event was a single unrepeated event. All this alone gives real content to that which we call theosophic intuition. But all this, however, is inconceivable without the objectivity of the event of Golgotha. In pre-Christian times, men in a certain respect were different. When they descended out of spiritual worlds into earthly incarnations, they took with them a certain amount of the divine element as substance. This divine element gradually became exhausted the further man pushed forward in his earthly incarnations, and was quite exhausted by the time when the events of Palestine drew near. Consequently, in pre-Christian times, when a man reflected on his own weakness, he always felt that the best that he had had originated in the divine spheres from which he had come down. Men still felt the last after effects of the divine element. That element, however, was exhausted when John the Baptist declared, quote, "Change your conception of the world, for the times have become different. Now you will no longer be able, as heretofore, to rise up into the spiritual, for the outlook into the old spirituality is no longer possible. Change your ideas, and accept that divine being who is to give anew to men that which they had to lose through their descent to earth." Close quote. Consequently, though we may disavow it, when we think in the abstract, we cannot disavow it if we look at external history in the concrete. The whole feeling and perception of man changed at the turning point of the old and the new epochs, the boundary of which is marked by the events of Palestine. Men began to feel themselves forsaken after the events of Palestine had taken place. They began to feel themselves forsaken when they approached the hardest questions which concerned the innermost part, the most concrete part of the soul. They asked themselves, for example, quote, "What will become of me and my whole connection with the universe when I go through the gate of death with a number of deeds that have not been made good?" Close quote. Then these persons were met by a thought, which certainly might be born from out of the longing of the soul, a longing, however, which could only be satisfied through the fact that the human soul reached the vision, quote, "Yes, a being has lived, who entered into the evolution of humanity, on whom thou canst lay hold, and who, in the outer cosmos, whither thou canst not come, is working to bring about the compensation of thy deeds, one who will help thee to make good that which has been made evil by the Luciferic influences." Close quote. Through this feeling oneself forsaken, and the feeling oneself rescued by an objective power, there enters into humanity a feeling that sin is a real power, an objective fact. And the other fact that belongs to it is that the act of redemption is an objective fact, that it is something which the individual cannot accomplish because he did not by magic bring in the Luciferic influence. but which only he could accomplish who works in the worlds in which Lucifer consciously works. All that I have thus set before you in words, taken out of Theosophy, was not grasped as concept, did not exist as cognition, but rested in feelings and sense perceptions. In the feelings and sense perceptions, there lived the necessity to turn to Christ. There was, of course, for these persons, the possibility of finding in Christian communities ways by which they could deepen all such perceptions and feelings. What did man find eventually at the time when he had lost his connection with divine beings, when he looked out externally into matter? Through the coming down of man into matter, the vision of the spiritual, of the psychic divine in the great cosmos, had been lost more and more. The remains of the old clairvoyance, which were still there, were gradually lost. And nature became in a definite way deprived of the divine. A purely material world was spread out before man. And in face of this material world, man could not in the least preserve his faith that in it the Christ principle must be objectively at work. The conception of Kant and Laplace, further developed in the 19th century, that the cosmic system of which our earth is part formed itself into globes from cosmic mist, and that life arose on individual planets, has led eventually to the whole universe being regarded as a cooperation of atoms. When we take this conception and think Christ into it, when we think Christ into the cosmogony of the materialistic natural scientist, it is simply senseless. In this cosmogony, the Christ being cannot be maintained. In this cosmogony, nothing spiritual can be maintained. You know that someone said, as I read it to you, that he would have to break through his whole conception of the universe if he had to believe in the resurrection. This whole conception of the universe, which gradually arose, only shows that as regards thinking about external nature, the possibility has disappeared of penetrating into the living essence or natural facts. When I speak in this way, it is not in depreciation. The time had to come when nature was deprived of the divine, deprived of the spirit, so that man could grasp the totality of abstract thoughts required to comprehend external nature, as rendered possible by the views of Copernicus, Kepler, and Galileo. The web of thoughts which has led to our age of machinery had to envelop humanity. But, on the other hand, it was necessary that this age should have a compensation for what there could not be in exoteric life, a compensation for the fact that it had become impossible to find the direct path from the earth to the spiritual. For, had man been able to find the path to the spiritual, he would have been able to find the path to Christ, as he will find it in the coming centuries. There had to be a compensation. The question now is, what had become necessary as an exoteric path for man to Christ during the centuries in which an atomistic conception of the universe became gradually accepted, a conception which more and more alienated nature from the divine, and which, in the 19th century, grew into the study of nature deprived of the divine? A twofold remedy was necessary. The spiritual vision of the Christ could be found exoterically in two ways. The one way was to show man the possibility that it certainly is not true that all matter is completely foreign to his own inner spiritual being. He could actually be shown that it is not correct to say that everywhere in space where matter appears, only matter is present. How could this come about? in no other way than by something being given to man, which is at one and the same time spirit and matter, something of which he must know that it is spirit, and of which he sees that it is matter. That the following had to remain a vital fact, vis-à-vis the transformation, the eternally valid transformation of spirit into matter, of matter into spirit. And this came to pass through the fact that the Holy Communion has been celebrated, has been preserved through the centuries as a Christian ceremony. And the further we go back in the centuries since the institution of the Holy Communion, the more we can trace how the older times, not yet so materialistic, understood it better. In regard to higher things, as a rule, when people begin to discuss anything, it is a proof they no longer understand it. Even simple matters, as long as they are understood, are not much discussed. Discussions are a proof that the majority of those who discuss do not understand the question. Thus it was with the Holy Communion. As long as it was known that the Holy Communion furnished the living proof that matter is not merely matter, but that there are ceremonial acts through which the spirit can be united with matter, as long as man knew that this interpenetration of matter with spirit, as it finds expression in the Holy Communion, is an interpenetration with Christ, so long was the Holy Communion accepted without any strife. But then came the time when materialism arose, when people no longer understood what lies at the foundation of the Holy Communion. Then they disputed whether bread and wine are merely symbols of the divine, or whether divine force actually flows into them. For him who can see more deeply, all the disputes which arose at the very beginning of the new epoch signify nothing else than that the original understanding for the matter had been lost. The Holy Communion, for those who desired to come to Christ, was a complete equivalent for the esoteric path, if they could not take that path. And thus in the Holy Communion they could find a real union with Christ. But all things have their time. Certainly, just as it is true that in regard to the spiritual life a quite new age is dawning, so it is also true that the way to Christ, which for centuries was the right one for many people, will still remain for centuries more the right one for many. Things pass over only gradually into one another. That which formerly was right will gradually pass over into something else when persons are ready for it. And theosophy is to work in such a way that we shall grasp in the spirit itself something concrete, something real. By means of meditations, concentrations, and all that we learn as the knowledge of higher worlds, men become ripe in their inner being to experience not merely thought worlds, not merely worlds of abstract feelings and perceptions, but to permeate themselves inwardly with the element of the spirit. Thereby, they will experience the communion in the spirit. Thereby thoughts, meditative thoughts, will be able to live in man. They will even be the very same, only from within outward, as the symbol of the Holy Communion, the consecrated bread, has been from within, without inwards. Let me read that again. That last part. Thereby thoughts, meditative thoughts, will be able to live in man. They will even be the very same, only from within outwards, as the symbol of the Holy Communion, the consecrated bread, has been from without inwards. And as the undeveloped Christian can seek his way to Christ through the Holy Communion, so the developed Christian, who through advanced theosophy has learned to know the form of the Christ, can raise himself in spirit to that which in the future will be an exoteric path for men. That will flow as the force which is to bring to man an expansion of the Christ impulse. But then all ceremonies will change, and that which formerly happened through the attributes of bread and wine will happen in the future through spiritual communion. The thought of the sacrament, the Holy Communion, will remain. Only it must be made possible that certain thoughts will flow to us through what is imparted within the Theosophical movement. Certain inner thoughts and feelings shall interpenetrate and spiritualize our inner being. Thoughts and feelings as fully consecrated as in the best sense of inner Christian development, the Holy Communion has spiritualized the human soul and filled it with the Christ. When this becomes possible, and it will be possible, we shall have progressed a stage further in evolution, and thereby the real proof will again be provided that Christianity is greater than its external form. For he has but a small opinion of Christianity who thinks that it will be obliterated when the external forms of the Christianity of a certain period are swept away. He only has the true idea of Christianity who is permeated with the conviction that all churches which have cherished the Christ thought, all external thoughts, all external forms, are temporal and consequently transitory, and that the Christ thought will ever live in new forms in the hearts and souls of men in the future, little as these new forms show themselves today. Thus Theosophy really first teaches us how, along the exoteric path, the Holy Communion had its significance in earlier times. The other exoteric path was through the Gospels, and here again we must be aware of what in earlier times the Gospels were still for men. The time does not lie so far behind us when the Gospels were not read as in the 19th century. They were read in those days as a life-giving fountain from whence something substantial passes over into the soul. They were not read, as I described in the first lecture of this course, in speaking of a false path, but they were so read that one saw, approaching from outside, that for which his soul was panting with thirst. They were so read that his soul found pictured therein the real Redeemer, of whom that soul knew quite certainly that he was there in the cosmos. For persons who understood how to read the Gospels in this way, endless questions were automatically settled, which for the intelligent, clever people of the 19th century first became questions. We need only recall how many times, in speaking of the Christ Jesus questions, in one form or another, it had to be said of quite clever people who have all science and learning at their fingers' ends, that to them the thought of Christ Jesus and the events of Palestine are truly not compatible with the modern conception of the universe. It is said by them in an apparently enlightened manner that when man did not know that the earth is quite a small heavenly body, he could believe that with the cross of Golgotha, a new, a special event happened upon the earth. But since Copernicus taught that the earth is a planet like others, can one still believe that Christ has wandered to us from another planet? Why should we believe that the earth is so exceptionally situated as was formerly thought? The following simile has been used, quote, "Since the conception of the universe has been so much enlarged, it seems as though one of the most important artistic reproductions or representations had taken place, not on the great stage of a capital city, but on a little stage of some provincial theater. The earth is such a tiny little cosmic body that the events of Palestine appear like the reproduction of a great cosmic drama on the stage of a little provincial theater. We can no longer imagine such a thing, because the earth is so small in comparison with the great universe." Close quote. It seems so clever when something like that is said, but after all, there is not so much shrewdness in it, for Christianity never asserted what is here apparently contradicted. Christianity has never once placed the beginning of the Christ impulse in the splendid places of the earth. It has always been a certain deep serious, excuse me, it has always seen a certain deep seriousness in the fact that the bearer of the Christ was allowed to be born in a stable among poor shepherds. Not only the little earth, but a place quite hidden on the earth was sought out in Christian tradition to place the Christ therein. Christianity from the very first answered the questions of the clever people, but these had not understood the answers which Christianity itself has given, because they could no longer let the living force of the great majestic pictures work upon the soul. Nevertheless, in the gospel pictures alone, without the Holy Communion and that which is connected with it, for the Holy Communion stands at the center of all Christian cults, man's exoteric path to Christ could not have been found. The Gospels could not have been universally accepted to that degree, because solely and entirely through them the way to Christ had had to become universally accepted. And when the Gospels were universally accepted, we can see that this did not bring such a very inward blessing. For with the popularizing of the Gospels, there arose also, at the same time, the great misunderstanding that they were taken superficially. Then all followed which the 19th century has made out of the Gospels, and which indeed, speaking objectively, is bad enough. I think theosophists will understand what is meant when one says bad enough. No censorious criticism is intended. We cannot but acknowledge the diligence which the 19th century has brought to the work of scientific investigation, including all work in natural science. What is precisely so tragic is that science, and he who knows it will grant this, owing to its deep seriousness and its tremendous and devoted industry, for which we have only admiration, has led to a complete splitting up, a destruction of that which the scientists wished to teach. The future evolution of humanity will feel it an especially tragic experience in the civilization of our age, that men desired to make a scientific conquest of the Bible by means of a science worthy of endless admiration, but that this science only succeeded in losing the Bible. Thus we see that in both directions, in regard to what is exoteric, we are living in a transitional period. And in so far as we have grasped the spirit of theosophy, the old paths must lead over into others. After having thus considered the exoteric paths of the past to the Christ impulse, we shall see in the next lecture how this relationship to Christ takes form in the sphere of the esoteric. We shall then conclude our study by showing how we are in a position to grasp the Christ event not only for the whole evolution of humanity, but for each individual man. We shall be able to review the esoteric path more briefly, because we have collected building stones during past years. We shall bring about the crowning of our structure by fixing our gaze upon the relationship of the Christ impulse to every individual human soul. The end of Lecture 9.